This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. The United States faces increasingly complex security challenges. We live in a world of dynamic threats and hazards, and we must adapt accordingly. For the U.S. Air Force, this does not mean change for change's sake, but purposeful, with strategic intent, always focusing on the first priority, which is duty to country and mission execution. It means, in a nutshell, fly, fight, and win. Of course, building the world's foremost air, space, and cyberspace force requires substantial investment, providing the best possible value to the American people. To that end, the U.S. Air Force must balance capabilities between current combat operations and the need to address emerging threats and challenges, with the ultimate aim to be lean, lethal, and agile. What is the strategic vision for today's U.S. Air Force? How is the Air Force managing in an era of fiscal constraint? What is the Air Force doing to improve its operations and become a more efficient and agile force? We'll explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Erin Connaughton, Undersecretary of the U.S. Air Force. Welcome, Erin.
Great, Michael and John. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is John Vonglis. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Madam Secretary.
Erin, to provide some context, perhaps you could give us a brief overview of the history and mission of your office, the Undersecretary for the Air Force.
Sure. The Air Force is a younger service than our Army and Navy brothers, but it was created as part of the National Security Act in 1947. And so since the time of the Air Force, we have had an undersecretary. It was interesting in preparing for this conversation. We went back to look at what the responsibilities of the undersecretary of the Air Force were in 1947. And it was things like procurement, industrial mobilization, materiel requirements, atomic energy, which is it's just interesting to sort of see where we've come as an organization over time. There was a period in the early 2000s, from about 2002 to 2007, where the undersecretary was very focused on the space mission. The folks who had the jobs at that time were triple-hatted. They were the undersecretary of the Air Force, they were the DOD executive agent for space, and they were the director of the National Reconnaissance Office. So while they had the broad range of responsibilities given to an undersecretary, they really had very substantial space responsibilities that took up a lot of their time. And then from 2007 until I arrived in 2010, there was no undersecretary of the Air Force, as John knows keenly well. So a lot of what we did when we arrived in 2010 was to kind of re-envision the role, obviously with the blessing of Secretary Donnelly, who's the Secretary of the Air Force. So at the broadest level, my responsibilities as Undersecretary are organizing, training, and equipping the people and the equipment of the United States Air Force in partnership with the Secretary. I act as Acting Secretary on his behalf when he's not in town. And I know we're going to chat about my roles as Chief Management Officer. Mm-hmm. That's a recent innovation from the Congress. And then I have some very specific responsibilities given to me by the Secretary for energy as the Senior Energy and Sustainability Official, for space as the Air Force focal point for space, and in terms of our nuclear weapons work.
Important mission, a very vital portfolio, it looks like. But operationally, could you tell us a little bit about the budget you steward, and how do you support the overall DoD mission?
Sure. I'd love to do that. If I give you just a little bit of context on the scope of the enterprise that we deal with as an Air Force. In terms of people, we're about 334,000 active duty, about 153,000 civilians, and then another 170 or so thousand in our reserve component. So if you added that all up, I took a look at this. The Air Force employs more people than Citigroup and UPS combined. We're, if you took our revenue, about $115 billion in our budget, we'd be number 7 on the Fortune 500 list, above AT&T and above Ford. And in terms of scope, we can get into this when we talk energy later, but our Air Force installations are about 10 million acres, about 2 times the size of my home state of New Jersey. And if you look at our facilities footprint, we're about 626 million square feet. That's roughly the size of Walmart globally. So when we think about managing an enterprise of that scale, it's a little eye-watering. The Air Force in today's fight is providing just a range of capabilities to our joint partners. So people, obviously, when they think of the Air Force, they think of fighter planes, and we certainly have those providing support to the ground forces who are in combat in Afghanistan and who were in combat in Iraq. But we also have a lot of intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance assets. So people know of the drones, as they're called, these unmanned aerial vehicles, as well as a range of other manned capabilities. We've got our mobility force, which picks up people and equipment and moves it from the United States to wherever it needs to go. They do an amazing job. We've got special operations forces that are working with the other special operations forces from the other services over there. And then obviously we've got our space and cyber capabilities, which allow everybody to do what they need to do on the ground. So the other thing I would say before getting into kind of the current context is that the Air Force has gotten actually smaller since 9/11. Most people remember that the Army and the Marine Corps have grown quite substantially, but the Air Force is actually a little bit smaller than we were on 9/11, both in terms of our active duty force and our total size of our Air Force. And our budget in real terms has come down since if you look at 1985 as the height of defense spending, the Army's up about 60%. The Navy is about plus 4%, but the Air Force is down about 20%. The reason I highlight this is, I guess on a positive note, to say that we've learned how to do more with less. So one of the things as we look ahead under this new fiscal environment, we're very much in line with the President and Secretary Panetta's newly released strategy, which says we're going to continue to maintain our capability in counterterrorism, but we're also going to ensure that we can fight in a range of contingencies. And we think the Air Force is perfectly suited to operate across that whole range of missions.
Madam Secretary or Aaron, thank you again. And thank you for those enlightening yet sobering comments, because most people were and continue to be unaware exactly what the role and the mission of the Air Force is, especially 20 years continuously in a combat mission, if you will. And regarding and picking up from some of those responsibilities and duties and challenges, could you please describe for our audience what you would whittle down to maybe 3 top or more challenges that you're facing?
You know, I think the 3 big challenges that we've got, we always think about people first. And so part of what we are focused on is how do you move into this new budgetary context that we know is going to require reductions while doing right by our people? Because the people who serve in the United States Air Force, whether they're in uniform or are civilians, are the backbone of everything that we do. The other big challenge I think that we have is maintaining our operational excellence as the budgets come down. So budgets is a recurring theme here, but it's how we maintain all the good stuff that we want to do, even in a time of fiscal restraint. And it has created opportunities for us to go back and look at how we do business and say, is this really the smartest way to do it? Is it the most cost-effective way to do it? And then, you know, probably not to be tongue-in-cheek, but the third biggest challenge I think we face is time. Time on the calendar, time to get into the whole range of issues we might get into. As I was thinking about this, you know, I made a list of five or six other things that I think are in the number three place. And I think that just demonstrates that the scope of the issues in front of us guarantee that you're not going to get bored on any given day at the office.
Well, Aaron, given that experience around the Hill, both branches of government, now you're in the executive branch, what are the characteristics of an effective leader?
Yeah, one of the things that was really striking to me when I got to the Air Force was just the difference in scope. So when I was on the Hill, I was in charge of our committee staff, which was about 70 people. So everybody who worked for me, I knew personally, I knew their strengths, I knew exactly what they did, and I had a personal line of interaction with them. You know, you fast forward to the Air Force, and I told you the size of the operation, and our headquarters alone is thousands and thousands of people. And so one of the leadership challenges I've found is trying to build teams across a very large organization, particularly one that's geographically as diverse as we are. I think a lot of my leadership there has been about building teams, empowering people toward a goal, and then try to reward success. The pace is so quick that we don't often stop just to sort of say to the team, look at what we've done. This is really remarkable. So trying to provide that kind of feedback, I think, is really important. And the great thing about the military is you're around people who've been steeped in leadership for their entire careers. And so I've been very lucky to learn from a lot of really gifted leaders, both in uniform and in the civilian world since I've been there. And I've been blessed to have really great bosses over time, including my current boss. And I learn something from him every single day.
What is the strategic vision for today's U.S. Air Force? We will ask Aaron Connaughton, Undersecretary of the U.S. Air Force, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What are the seven management imperatives all government executives need to know? How is DoD improving its business operations? What is FAA's next generation air transportation system, or NextJet? How is New York City shaping a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and more efficient? And what about power, security, and leadership in the 21st century? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Aaron Connaughton, Undersecretary of the United States Air Force. Aaron, given the nation's budgetary challenges and fiscal constraint, U.S. Armed Forces must balance capabilities between current operations and the need to address emerging threats. To that end, would you give us a highlight of the Air Force's strategic goals and management principles that inform that vision? And more importantly, how do your goals, your Air Force's goals, align to and support the overall national defense strategy?
Absolutely. And it's a great question right now, given that there's a new defense strategy. We talked about a little bit before that strategy calls for the United States to maintain its military capability across a range of conflicts. So all the lessons that we've learned in Iraq and Afghanistan over the last 10 years, we see those continuing to be brought to bear as we conclude the conflict in Afghanistan, but also as we undertake counterterrorism operations against al-Qaeda and its affiliates globally. As I mentioned, we're going to be prepared to deal with aggression in any corner of the globe that we find it, and particularly to ensure that the United States maintains its freedom of movement in those areas of the world where a potential adversary might want to keep us out. And we know that we have to do all this while we do other things like maintaining our nuclear capability as a nation. It's particularly important to the Air Force. We maintain two legs of the so-called triad, mm-hmm. which is the three different ways of delivering a nuclear weapon. And while the administration obviously believes that we should be moving ourselves to a world without nuclear weapons, we as the Air Force are dedicated to being good stewards of that capability for as long as it is part of our national arsenal. We have to do all this while doing cyber, homeland defense, a range of things that the nation expects its armed forces to bring forward. I went back to the goals that Secretary Donnelly and General Schwartz laid out for the Air Force when they came into office in 2008. And even though we have a new strategy, I think their goals and the goals that they've laid out for the Air Force still align pretty closely to where we're trying to go. So first and foremost for them was continuing to strengthen our nuclear enterprise. Critically important, too, has been to ensure, as General Schwartz often says, that folks understand that we are all in the current conflict. So our people are absolutely critical to us. We have been seeking to modernize our aerospace and cyber inventories. One of the things about the Air Force is we've got a lot of very aging platforms. A lot of people know about our tanker fleet mm-hmm. because it was much in the news for a period of time. That fleet is almost 50 years old on average, and our fighters and bombers, while younger, are also in the decades and decades old. So one of the challenges we face in this budgetary context is that we've got a lot of modernization programs that are just ready to get going. Obviously, our tanker program, critically important to us, and we're very excited that that acquisition process is complete and we're able to move forward to actually procure those planes. Many people know about the F-35, the Joint Strike Fighter, which is the future of our fighter force, and we're moving ahead with that. But we've got a lot of other modernization efforts sort of waiting in the wings, some to do with our nuclear weapons, some to do with our helicopter fleets, some to do with the training aircraft we use to make sure our pilots are ready to get into these advanced platforms. And the last thing that we hold up as one of our core priorities is improving our acquisition process, people, and systems. I know we're going to get an opportunity to delve into that a little bit more, but we've made great progress on that in the last couple of years, and I know it's something that our Secretary and Chief are very proud of.
As Undersecretary, you're also the Air Force's Chief Management Officer, charged with driving the organization toward ever greater effectiveness and efficiency. Would you please elaborate on what it means to be a Chief Management Officer, something not normally found in the private sector? And how do you interact with the Defense Department, the OSD offices, and the other services in that role? And finally, have there been any changes to the CMO role within your organization from when the time you and your colleagues wrote the law and made it an effect to the present?
Sometimes I feel like being Chief Management Officer means that every hard issue finds its way into my office, but I know I'm not alone in that. At its most macro level, it's what you highlighted, John, and certainly, you know, honor the work that you did in getting this stood up. For listeners who perhaps don't know, John acted in the role of the first Chief Management Officer for the Air Force at a time when there was no undersecretary, and so I'm standing on the shoulders of giants, if you will.
Very kind. Thank you so very much for that.
No,
you're
very
one of the
welcome.
Few that recognize it, but thank you for doing so.
Of course. So at its most basic level, we're trying to drive improvements in our business processes and trying to make sure that things like business systems, the IT that we buy, that we think about how we're going to use that and that we improve our processes along the way. So there's a lot of work at multiple levels of the organization to look at how we do business and to try to improve it. I mean, that's a very simplistic way of saying it. I end up in this hat having a lot of responsibility for building budgets and for management of those programs that have an impact on the business side of our institution. So my counterpart in the uniform side, the number two military officer in the Air Force, the Vice Chief of Staff, General Phil Breedlove, he and I are partners, both as people and statutorily, if you will, or in terms of our regulation, in running what we call the Air Force Council. So we try to make decisions in collaborative decision-making bodies that start at the colonel level, the O6 level, and sort of come up to the culminating group, which is the Air Force Council, chaired by the two of us. And then ultimately, we'll bring decisions to the Secretary and to the Chief of Staff of the Air Force for ultimate disposition. But we try to do a lot of our management oversight in the course of that regular decision-making process. There's a huge amount of collaboration with our OSD and service partners. So I know some of your listeners might have had the chance to listen when Beth McGrath, who's the Deputy Chief Management Officer for the entire Department of Defense, was on. We meet with her very regularly. The Deputy Secretary of Defense, who is the Chief Management Officer for the Department of Defense, convenes us as a group to work on these issues on an ongoing basis. And there's been some tweaks to the legislation over time, not extensive. I would say in the time that I've been there, there are two things. One, the efficiencies initiative that Secretary Gates championed, which allowed us to move about $33 billion from support activities into key warfighting capabilities. We are, as Chief Management Officer, I'm really at the head of the pyramid, if you will, in terms of trying to make sure that we actually achieve those efficiencies and that we understand the second order impacts of them. And the other thing that's relatively new is the drive, the accelerated drive for audit readiness and trying to empower and enable our Chief Financial Officer, Dr. Morin, Jamie Morin, and his team as they seek to meet Secretary Panetta's goals on an accelerated basis.
I mean, these are enterprise issues, right?
They are enterprise issues. So it's rare to find an issue where we're not all dealing with something of the same nature. You know, I mean, you look at sort of the enterprise resource programs, these so-called ERPs, these large IT systems that we're trying to employ to improve our logistics work, our pay and personnel work, our financial systems. And some of us are further ahead than others in different areas, but we're all sort of struggling our way through that. We're all dealing with the audit readiness effort, and we're all dealing with the efficiencies management.
Well, actually, that's what I'd like to talk about a little bit, is the efficiency gains.
Right.
As you mentioned, the Air Force identified $33.3 billion, I believe, in efficiencies. Could you tell us a little bit more about what you've done, maybe some key examples in this area? What are some of the critical challenges you faced, and more importantly, what remains to be done?
Sure. This was a huge effort that took the teamwork of the entire Department of the Air Force to work on. So on the efficiency side of the house, what we did was we looked at each part of our business. So we looked at logistics, we looked at IT, we looked at our management structure, we looked at support contracts, we looked at acquisition systems, just a range of issues. And we tried to look at industry best practices. So probably the best example I can give you there is in terms of what our mobility air forces, so these are the big transport planes or the refueling planes. They tend to be roughly of the size of commercial airlines. And so we spend a lot of time benchmarking ourselves against best practices in the commercial airline industry. And what we found is that if we could fly smarter, so get rid of excess weight, think about power utilization better, think about flying ways that are more efficient, that they were able to identify about $715 million worth of fuel efficiencies over a five-year period that could be achieved by making best use of what we know about how the commercial airlines fly. Same thing on the IT side in terms of consolidating data centers and a range of other activities that we've seen in our industrial partners. So in addition to sharing best practices within the Department of Defense, we definitely look to partner with folks in industry and to learn where they're ahead of us, to learn from their experiences as we go forward. So the big challenges for us going forward are actually achieving those things. You know, we came up with the great ideas. We think they're pretty realistic, but now we got to get after actually making them a reality. The other thing that's been a big thing for us is that in the very closing days of the build of the 2012 budget, we were given direction by the Department of Defense, everyone was, to limit the growth in our civilian workforce. And so for us in the Air Force, we had intended to grow by about 21,500 people over the course of 5 years for things like acquisition, for insourcing that that had been scheduled to come in-house, a range of activities. And under the new rule set, we were only allowed to grow about 4,000 people. So that constituted a pretty significant change from what the Air Force plan had been. And so we've spent the better part of the last year looking in a very strategic way at what functions must we take care of first and ensuring in a strategic way. What we didn't want to do is to just salami slice the cuts and say every organization takes a whatever, a 10% cut or whatever the number would have been. So we tried hard to do it very strategically and to say those five top priorities I talked about earlier, let's make sure that we've got people arrayed against them first and then look at, you know, lower and lower levels of priority. It's been very difficult. Changes of that magnitude are not without pain.
And these are tough decisions that you're making. But perhaps you can give us a sense of the resource allocation process within the Air Force. Sure. More particularly, how are decisions made and what office? Who's responsible?
Yeah, we try to do this in a very collaborative way. So I mentioned the Air Force Council, which is the ultimate, well, the Secretary and the Chief of Staff are the ultimate decision makers, but the Air Force Council is sort of the last stop in the budget build before it goes to them. So we've got a what we call an Air Force group, and then an Air Force board, and then an Air Force council. And decisions come up through that chain. But our budgets really start with our commanders. So they build what they think is the ideal budget, and then it comes to the headquarters, and everybody starts working their way through it and teeing up strategic choices. That's one of the things that that I've tried to work on most. And I think it's because I built budgets for 10 years in the Congress and was used to teeing up hard decisions for a senior decision maker. So what we've tried to do is to look at a budget in a holistic, strategic sense, but to also make very crisp the tough decisions that we need the Secretary and the Chief to step up to. And as you can imagine, in the current budgetary environment, there's no lack of those. And then after we submit it, we join the larger Department of Defense budget exercise, which, the new Deputy Secretary of Defense, I think, has been very innovative and collaborative in the way that he's brought decisions to the table for the department.
Going back to something that you mentioned earlier, for the benefit of our audience, sure, that the Air Force has been flying and for 20 years in Iraq in the no-fly zones and, of course, the missions in Afghanistan. But even prior to that, when we go back 40, 50 years in some cases of some platforms that are still in existence, it's not necessarily the age but the utilization of some of these aircraft. One would think that the realization of efficiencies would allow the Air Force to reallocate funding and to modernize and to recapitalize weapon systems and elements of the fleet that require it. Could you outline some examples or enhancements of use in this area?
Yeah, it's a great question, and thank you. This was exactly Secretary Gates' idea when he put forward the efficiency initiative, was to challenge the services not only to find the efficiencies, but to plow them into really needed combat capability. So probably the number one thing for the Air Force was restarting a program that would bring us a new long-range penetrating bomber. Our bomber fleet is aging, as we know, and we only have one platform, the B-2, that has the stealth capabilities that would allow it to be effective against some of the most sophisticated air defense systems that are out there. And we know that those air defense systems are continuing to evolve and get better. And so our bombing capability needs to keep up with those advances. So really critical for us is not only that bomber, but it fits within what we call a family of systems, the long-range strike family of systems, which recognizes that you don't just need to be able to put a bomb on a target. given the advances in technology, you need to be able to jam somebody who's trying to come after you. You need to have the intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance to ensure that you know where you're going and if somebody else is coming after you. And you need to be sure that you've got the communications capability, that you're sure that you can communicate with each other, even in a very challenging threat environment. So that's probably the first place that we put a lot of our efficiency investments. The other thing we did, and we can talk about this as we get into the space work, is we put more money into our space launch. It's a big piece of what we do, safely delivering satellites to orbit, and we are in a very busy period in terms of satellites being ready to go. So we put some more investment in there. And there's a range of other things we did as well, but those are probably some of the biggest ones in terms of where we put our dollars.
So we've spoken about the strategic priorities of the Air Force, management challenges as the chief management officer of the Air Force. I want to touch on and explore a little bit before we close the segment, the audit readiness requirement. Right. Congress has set that audit readiness be achieved by the end of fiscal year 2017, and Secretary Panetta has sought to accelerate this to 2014. My question really has to do with, how has this change, this acceleration, affected your progress thus far? And could you tell us a little bit more about your efforts in the area in general?
Absolutely. We were committed to audit readiness before the acceleration, and we remain deeply committed. It's not just that it's the right thing to do from a business perspective. Being audit ready and the things that go with it will allow us to be more effective managers of our equipment, to know where our stuff is and to ensure that we're making use of everything we have before we buy new things. One of the things that we've been impressing upon our leaders, and the Vice Chief of Staff and I signed out a memo to the force on this, is that audit readiness is not just about the financial management community. Mm-hmm. It's about every functional part of, in our case, the Air Force. And so we need commanders at every level to realize that this is not something that just exists in the comptroller's world. It's a responsibility throughout the force. So we've gone out to our commanders. We've ensured that among our senior executive service, our most senior career civilians, that each of them in their performance plan has a component that is related to audit because we think it's that important. So some of it's leadership from the top and persistent leadership from the top. There's no doubt that the acceleration to 2014 is going to be very challenging for us. It's not the full-up audit by 2014, but what is required by 2014 is fairly substantial. And probably the biggest challenge for us is that I mentioned these ERPs, these large IT systems. And so the challenge that we've had and that Dr. Jamie Morin has been leading quite effectively is trying to find alternative ways through our legacy systems or in some cases through, kind of manual approaches to ensure that we're going to get to 2014.
How is the Air Force managing in an era of fiscal constraint? We will ask Aaron Connaughton, Undersecretary of the U.S. Air Force, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is FAA's Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen? How is the U.S. Department of Homeland Security turning its one DHS vision into a reality? What is New York City doing to shape a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and more efficient? And how is the DoD improving its business operations? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Hear from FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, DHS Undersecretary for Management Raphael Boris, New York City Deputy Mayor for Operations Stephen Goldsmith, and Dave Winogrand, Assistant Deputy Chief Management Officer at DoD. Professor Joseph Nye and General Anthony Zinni on power, security, and leadership in the 21st century, and seven management imperatives that government leaders should pursue to be successful in an era of fiscal constraint. All of this and so much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Aaron Connaughton, Undersecretary of the United States Air Force. Aaron, DoD and civilian agencies in our nation rely on space capabilities developed and operated by the Air Force. However, space is a very expensive business. I think you mentioned that 20% of the Air Force modernization dollars are spent in this mission area. Would you tell us more about the Air Force space posture and provide an overview of the space investment that the Air Force makes? But more importantly, how are you exploring creative ways of enhancing capabilities and driving down costs in the Air Force space program?
Sure. The Air Force provides space capabilities not only to the rest of the Department of Defense, but really to the world. If you think of GPS, which is one of the critical things and a critical constellation for us, we do missile warning, so we would know if anybody was sending a missile inbound to the United States or elsewhere. We do communications, both wideband global communications as well as protected communications, to ensure that the president has the ability to speak to his forces, even in a nuclear scenario. And we have responsibilities for things like weather, which is critically important nationally, but also to our warfighters to know exactly what kind of weather they're walking into. We're in a high launch rate right now. Our operators have put 81 consecutive successful launches up. I greatly praise the tremendous space operators and the industry partners that we have that enable us to be that successful over time. That's part of the reason that we're spending as much in space as we are, because we're upgrading our missile warning capability. We've got what we call the Advanced Extremely High Frequency System of Satellites, which does protected communications. We're also trying to take some steps forward on the acquisition side to keep the cost of our space systems limited. And I might just mention two recent things that we've put forward as innovations. We, as part of the fiscal year 12 budget, we put forward a concept that we call EASE, or Evolutionary Acquisition for Space Efficiency. And its name is not as important as what it does, which is to try to get a good cost for the taxpayer and to provide stability to our industrial base. So what we try to do with this concept is to say, we're going to buy two satellites at a time. So it gives them stability, they can plan out for this, and in some cases they can get a better price on their parts because they're buying in more quantity than they would normally buy. It helps the lower level suppliers in the system. So we think that's a benefit to them. In return, we ask for, obviously, a good price, but also fixed price. Mm-hmm. We're picking only systems that are through the development phase of their life cycle, and so we should have a better handle on what their costs are. So fixed prices. We're also doing continuous R&D development, not for a particular satellite, but in a mission area, so that we continue to improve gradually over time rather than waiting for the next big innovation. And then the other thing that we've asked, and the Congress has been very kind to help us work through, is to spread the funding for these satellites over a period of years. We're also trying to get a handle on our launch enterprise. I mean, I talked about how successful it is operationally, and it's outstanding, but it's expensive. Mm-hmm. And it's been getting more expensive over time. We recently put out a strategy for what we call new entrants, so competitors who'd like to get into this business space. We think that competition over time will not only be good for the Air Force, but will be good for the taxpayer in terms of putting downward pressure on costs. At the same time, we recognize we only have one provider, and we're buying from that provider in an incredibly inefficient way. And so we're looking at a lot-buy kind of approach to ensure that we get the best fiscal deal possible until such time as new competitors are in this business space.
But beyond space acquisition, could you elaborate yet on something that's also important, and I think continues to be, is that the overall improvement in the Air Force acquisition program, and also your role in small business?
Sure. Well, as I mentioned, acquisition improvement is in the top five for the Secretary and the Chief. It's something that the senior leadership of the Air Force meets on very regularly, like on a weekly basis. So it has that level of senior leader oversight. The Air Force put together something called the Acquisition Improvement Plan, which came up with about 170 improvements, and we're diligently kind of working our way through getting those implemented. You know, it's the workforce, it's requirements generation, you know, sort of the things that we require that a system be able to do. It's budget discipline, it's contract attracting excellence. It's a whole range of things. Another thing that we've done, it's actually very relevant in the space arena too, but it's not limited to space, is the Department of Defense, when Ash Carter was Undersecretary for Acquisition Technology and Logistics, as well as our own service acquisition executive, Dave Van Buren, have been focusing on what they call should cost work. So we budget to what we think is the best estimate of what something will cost, but we're diligently going through each program to say, what should the taxpayer be paying for this system?
Aaron, the Air Force is the largest consumer of energy in the federal government. In addition to driving down procurement costs, the Air Force is thinking about ways to realize efficiencies and pursue a more sustainable path. Would you tell us more about the Air Force's efforts in this area? What is being done to diversify fuel supply sources and reduce consumption? And how are you leveraging private sector and industry practices in this area?
We are the largest consumer of energy in the federal government. We're about 11% of the total aviation fuel market. If you took the number of gallons of fuel that we burn in a given year, we burn more than U.S. Airways and FedEx combined. It's a significant operation that we are running, and it's a mission-driven operation. That fuel enables equipment and people to get where they need to be to save lives on the battlefield. So the mission is something that we take incredibly seriously. But we do have an energy plan, an energy strategy that's got basically three components to it. The first is reducing demand. And we've got goals on fuel consumption. We've got goals on the energy that we use at our installations. On the supply side, we're trying, as you rightly pointed out, to diversify our sources of supply. And what we've said to industry is that by 2016, it's our goal to be ready to procure 50% of our fuel from alternative sources if industry can provide it at a cost-competitive price. We've got 99% of our fleet across our aircraft is certified on the so-called Fischer-Tropsch fuel sources. We're about 90% there in terms of biofuels, and we're doing some limited testing on the what they call the third pathway, the alcohol to jet fuel, to see if there's some viability there. But we're also, you know, we've had some great success stories. You know, we were the first to sort of fly transatlantic, first to fly supersonic on alternative fuels. And this past May at Andrews Air Force Base, at Joint Base Andrews, our Thunderbirds flew on biofuel. Yeah. And then the last part of the energy strategy is changing our culture, just making our entire workforce aware of energy, both the energy that they use in their work and, you know, the simple things like turning off the lights. But we found really great kind of innovative practices that are popping up in different places.
Excellent. Thank you. And Aaron, I know that you're a big supporter of people and across the, you know, the enterprise. And to the extent that mission effectiveness is linked to the overall well-being of service members and their families, would you elaborate just a bit, at least, on Air Force programs that seek to foster a greater sense of community, strengthen the sense of belonging and value to the Air Force, and improve airmen and families' lives?
Absolutely. I mean, again, this is one of the top five priorities for our Air Force. And for me, you know, when you ask me about the greatest challenges we're facing, I put people first, because honestly, if we don't have the right people and the most high quality people, we can't. Those fancy airplanes only work if you've got really great people to fly them and maintain them and to support them. So this is an area of continued focus. As we're looking at the budgetary environment going forward, we've been committed to sustaining programs that support our airmen and support our families. So we may be a smaller force over time, but we want to ensure that the folks who remain with us, they and their families have the best that we can possibly offer. And that's a range of things. We've spent a lot of time, because we've talked about the continuous deployments that the Air Force has been in for 20 years, we spend a lot of time and focus on what we call resilience, making sure that folks and their families can deal with that period of time away and then returning to a family situation or to whatever situation they come home to, and that they've got tools that help them, mentally, they've got tools that help them physically, and emotionally, and in terms of their social interactions. And so we call this comprehensive airman fitness, and there's a range of programs that are designed to improve that capability. They've also, I mean, this is sort of a specific thing, but I had the opportunity with the vice chief to visit there last year. We've established something called the Deployment Transition Center, which is at Ramstein in Germany. And many of our troops who are leaving at that time, either Iraq or Afghanistan, go through Ramstein either to take a military flight home or to go through the commercial airport at Frankfurt. And so this is a space that's sort of a halfway house, you know, an opportunity to come out of combat and have a space where you can begin to think about transitioning back into a civilian space, so that they're not making that transition cold with their young children wanting to spend time with them, or with the pressures of whatever's happening at home. And we haven't just offered it to airmen. We've offered it to other service folks who might want to take advantage of it. And we've gotten great feedback that it really helps, because we're seeing a lot of troubling trends, you know, the number of suicides, sexual assault, a range of things that are just, we're deeply committed to reversing. And some of that is providing our airmen an ability to come back from deployment and, you know, return to a good place. At the same time, we're still committed deeply to the programs that support the families on the home front, whether or not their airman is co-located with them or whether they're deployed. And so a range of things provided at airmen and family readiness centers at each of our installations, to include a range of youth programs that we're going to stay committed to going forward, because we recognize that this is a family undertaking, you know, where our airmen are the ones who raise their right hand and swear an oath, but it is that entire family unit that's supporting that airman and allowing him or her to be successful.
What does the future hold for the United States Air Force? We will ask Aaron Connaughton, Undersecretary of the Air Force, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Each edition of the Business of Government magazine has as its focus the core mission of the IBM Center, connecting research to practice as a means to improve public management. We do this by bringing together insights and perspectives blended with an equal measure of practicality and reflection from an array of government leaders, public managers, thinkers, and practitioners. Hi, I'm Michael Keegan, Managing Editor of the Business of Government magazine. In an era of fiscal contraction, today's leaders face unique challenges that present many difficult choices. It is a period that, while imposing many constraints, simultaneously confers as many opportunities to make a difference, introduce new ways of managing, explore pragmatic approaches, and pursue management imperatives that help government leaders perform in an ever-challenging, complex environment. In our latest edition, we bring you conversations with FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, outlining the Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen. Rafael Boris, DHS Undersecretary for Management, discusses how the department is turning its one DHS vision into a reality. Stephen Goldsmith, Deputy Mayor for Operations for the City of New York, discusses how the city is shaping a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and efficient. We offer perspectives on power, security, and leadership in the 21st century from Professor Joseph S. Nye Jr. and General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command. Our forum presents 7 management imperatives that government leaders must pursue to be successful in this new environment. All of this and so much more in the Spring-Summer 2011 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Aaron Connaughton, Undersecretary of the United States Air Force. So, Aaron, I have the pleasure to talk to most of my guests about the power of collaboration and the importance of partnerships. How is the Air Force leveraging collaboration and partnerships to improve management outcomes?
We're doing it in a variety of ways. I think about our partnership on 3 levels. One is inside the Department of Defense, because the Air Force, compared to most federal agencies, is already big enough, and then we're within this massive organization called the Department of Defense, the interagency, and then our industry partners. And there's a huge amount of collaboration cross services and between the Office of Secretary of Defense and each of the military departments. We actively try to find lessons learned and ways to work together that is more efficient but also provides a better outcome. So some of that's, you know, the excellent leadership that exists across across the department, and some of it is just that organizations are getting more used to working more closely together. In terms of the interagency, we do a fair amount of work with folks like the FAA on airspace management issues here in the United States. I personally do most of my interagency work on space issues, so huge amount of collaboration with the National Reconnaissance Office, with NASA, and to a lesser extent with NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, because of our weather work. Our industry partnership is really critical. You know, the chief management officer side of the house maintains a robust dialogue with a lot of industrial leaders, so that in areas like logistics and other things, we're not recreating the wheel, but we're trying to learn from perhaps what other large organizations have had to face over the, you know, the last period of years.
Aaron, if we accept that we've moved from a world of bipolar threats to asymmetrical threats to God knows what tomorrow, and that's what's a bit of a loaded question, do you think the Air Force is structured properly at the Secretariat headquarters level to meet not only today's threats, but perhaps the unknowns of tomorrow? And with that, the skill set of the personnel that exists, the staff and you know, all across, you know, the board, do you think that they possess the requisite skills? And if not, what are we doing? What are you doing to ensure that gap does not grow significantly?
Well, if I think about the headquarters piece first, I would say, you know, we're never finished evolving. There's, you know, you have to be a learning organization and sort of see how things change over time. You know, if you went back to 2007, say, before we put this emphasis on our nuclear work, we didn't have an office on the air staff that was 100% dedicated to the nuclear enterprise. We didn't have a command that was 100% dedicated to that. We've consolidated the work that our chief information officer does with the work in command and control that's given traditionally to a senior officer on the air staff. So we have very senior officer, Lieutenant General Bill Lord, who's dual-hatted as what we call our A6, which is, you know, has responsibility for communications and the like, as well as our chief information officer. Now, we're blessed in the Air Force that we have a very tight alignment of our secretariat and our air staff. And for folks listening who are perhaps not as familiar with the Defense Department, the military departments have a secretariat sort of led by the secretary, sort of the civilian side of the house, and then a uniform staff that supports the chief of staff, in this case of the Air Force. Our secretary and chief have set a tremendous example, and we've got, I'm told, the closest interaction between those two sides of the house that folks have seen in their memory, which really puts us well ahead of the game in terms of just focusing on problems and working them rather than deconflicting, you know, who's doing what to whom. I'm not saying that never happens, but we have managed to minimize those kind of opportunities. As we dealt with the reductions in the dollars available for civilian growth, we had to look at where to put resources within the headquarters. And so we're doing a very careful scrub, not only of support positions that might be able to be eliminated, but looking at whether there are different combinations of offices that could be combined and still be effective. And that work's not done yet, but we're continuing to look at that. The other thing, and I'll, you know, praise my boss for his vision on this, is we're looking at combining the personnel systems that support our active duty, our reserve, Air Force Reserve, and our National Guard. Mm-hmm. Right now, they're three completely separate systems, and the challenge that people have when they move from one organization to another, which many people do, is that it's easy for them to sort of fall off for a period of time and perhaps have a gap in pay before the other system picks them up. And so he's moving us to he calls it 3-to-1, so three personnel systems down to one, which we think is going to be really wonderful for our airmen. In terms of the skills that we have, I guess I'd just mention two things. The Air Force is a very technically sophisticated service, and we need a lot of folks who have so-called, you know, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, the so-called STEM capabilities. And so we are working hard to encourage young people to get into this area. I am, and others of my colleagues are mentoring high school students who go to a technical high school here in Washington, D.C., who are thinking about pursuing a college career in this area, partly to, you know, to encourage them as young men and women generally, but also to encourage those who might think about a future in one of the more technical fields. We are really in need of ensuring that that best science and engineering talent continues to come into the United States Air Force. The other thing I would say, and this is certainly true in the business space, that those of us who have served in government most of our career don't always have the industry experience that would allow us to see some of the business problems in the most complete light. And so we do make use of what we call highly qualified experts, you know, folks who come with a great business background or a great technical background and make use of them for a period of time that they're willing to offer us. And as we evolve our business systems, that's been pretty important to us.
Erin, I'd like to turn to the future. Put your crystal ball up, if you will. What are some of the major opportunities and challenges you think the Air Force will face in the future, and how do you think it will evolve to meet those challenges?
Yeah, it's a big question. I mean, obviously, the biggest challenge for us is the budgetary situation in which we find ourselves. And what's very helpful is that the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs have laid out this very clear strategic vision. So it provides us a roadmap, even though the choices are going to be very painful, for how to prioritize. But, you know, as I say to folks when I go around, and I've had the opportunity to travel to, you know, a large number of Air Force installations, I remind them that this is an exciting time. I mean, this is a time when you have an inflection point like this, where you're coming out of a conflict, as we are, and as your budgetary situation changes, yes, it's a time of great stress, but it's also an opportunity to put ideas on the table that maybe you couldn't have put on the table 2 years ago. So I think that some of the opportunity for us as leaders is to encourage innovative thinking and to have people recognize that this is an exciting time to serve. It's not. It shouldn't be a period of dread for federal service. I mean, as I say to folks, you know, yes, it's difficult, but you're putting your fingers on the future of the United States Air Force for the next 30 years by the things that we're doing in these coming budget cycles. So I try to be a glass half full kind of person.
That's actually a good segue, because I want to get what's some advice you would give to somebody who's thinking about a career in public service?
I would say absolutely do it. I don't think there is any more rewarding career than the work that we do here in government, which is not to say anything negative about our partners in industry and elsewhere, but it is a really rewarding job, particularly in the Department of Defense, because you know every day that what you're doing is supporting real men and women in a real fight and their families. And I find that to be a really easy thing to get up out of bed and do in the morning. And, you know, probably the most inspiring places that I've been in the 2 years I've been on the job is out to the Air Force Academy and down to our basic military training graduation down at Lackland Air Force Base. I was given the opportunity to swear in a group of newly enlisting airmen, and it'll bring tears to your eyes. I mean, just the quality of people who know that they're joining the military at a time when they are likely to be deployed, are likely to face stretches of time away from their families, and are likely to be under, you know, tremendous stress, and they voluntarily choose to do this. It's just awe-inspiring. And so, you know, for folks out there who would think about joining our civilian ranks, as I said earlier, we couldn't do what we do without our civilian workforce. I've frequently say to folks, the nature of the military system is that our uniformed officers and our non-commissioned officers rotate through jobs every 2 years, 2 to 3 years. People like myself who are political appointees, we are temporary by nature. We're there for some period of years, but no longer than 8, certainly. It's really our civilian workforce that's the continuity. They're the ones who not only help us build the policies, but execute them. Mm-hmm. And without, you know, that excellence that we are blessed to have in the federal workforce, we couldn't do what we do for the guys who are in harm's way. So anybody who's thinking about it, I say, come join us, please.
Aaron, I want to thank you for your time today, but more importantly, John and I would like to thank you for your dedicated service to the country.
Well, thank you. Thank you, John, and thanks, Michael. This has just been a wonderful opportunity. I thank your listeners for giving me an ear to talk a little bit about what the Air Force is doing, and mostly to pay tribute to the tremendous folks, both in uniform and in the civilian workforce, who make it all possible. So thank you very much.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation with Aaron Connaughton, Undersecretary of the United States Air Force. My co-host from IBM has been John Vonglis. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.
How is the U.S. Air Force improving financial information and achieving audit readiness? What is the U.S. Air Force doing to improve its financial operations, become more efficient, and control costs? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and much more with Dr. Jamie Morin, Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Financial Management and Controller, next week on the Business of Government Hour.